when I was watching television, it was very, very one, two-dimensional in a particular story or a bit of programming. I'm constantly thinking, how can I tell the stories that nobody else is telling or hearing? What's the angle of the story that's not being told?
Hello and welcome to Outlines, a podcast about sport, stories and the media. My name's Owen Connolly. Hope you're well. It is great to have you listening. Our guest this time is a pretty busy man, all told. Jordan Jarrett Bryant is the sports news correspondent for Channel 4 News, bringing reports from the intersection of sport, culture and politics to viewers of one of UK TV's best respected bulletins. He's the founder of Blackademic, a project that began as a forum for discussing issues affecting the Black British community and has evolved into a full-fledged production company staffed largely by people from underrepresented groups in the industry. He's a contributor to titles and platforms across the sector like TalkSport and the Guardian Football Weekly podcast, and also a former wheelchair basketball player who's been one of the faces of Channel 4's Paralympic coverage since 2012. And he recently became a lecturer at Brighton University and launched his own podcast, Jordan Jarrett Bryant's The World's Coolest Disabled, to explore the lives and experiences of all sorts of people with disabilities. So it was great to speak to him about the challenge of introducing more diverse perspectives into sports media, not just in terms of visibility, but in terms of which stories get told and how. It's a thoughtful conversation, but it's also a whole lot of fun. As ever, if you're enjoying Outlines, then please do spread the word. Share episodes, subscribe to and rate the podcast on your platform of choice, and get involved on social media. The links are in the show notes. We really do have some more fantastic stuff coming up, and it starts here with Jordan Jarrett Bryant. What does a typical week look like for you then?
Well, there's no typical week for me, if I'm being honest. And I like it that way. I like it that every week is quite different. Well, no, actually, that's a lie. Every week isn't necessarily different, but every week is unpredictable. There's a difference.
Sure.
So next week might look the same as this week. I just don't know that in a way that for most people, most jobs, they know, right, I've got to be in at work at 9:30. I do this. I leave at 5:30. I go home. But I can't preempt that. Do you know what I mean? So
yeah.
Every week isn't necessarily the same. Sometimes they are different. But I it's hard for me to kind of know that because of the nature of the work that I do. News largely, you know, changes from hour to hour, let alone week to week.
Yeah, I was going to say, is it a function of particularly the Channel 4 role that something might just come up and they'll say, Jordan, can you get yourself to Manchester or Birmingham or whatever?
Totally. Yeah, completely. I mean, if we don't do masses of sport, our bar for sport on Channel 4 News is quite high.
Yeah.
So it takes something in the week anyway, something quite big for us to cover a sports story when it blends into news. So, yeah, it's got to be like someone significant has just passed away, mm-hmm. or there has been a big announcement that Manchester City are going to be deducted points or relegated, or it's going to be there's Super League. Do you know what I mean? It's got to be like, this is a big story. In a way that with Sky Sports, BBC Sports, because they're out and out sports, they just cover everything across sports. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They cater for that particular audience.
Yeah. I mean, I'm keen to get into the balance of stuff you do as we go, but that's quite a nice route into the Channel 4 gig, which I suppose is probably going to be the one that takes you maybe on par with TalkSport, but takes you to the most people. It's the most visible, but not necessarily the one you were saying before we started recording that you spend the most time on, probably for that reason that you were talking about with where the bar for coverage is. I mean, it's a different kind of national news bulletin, really. I mean, people in the UK will kind of instinctively know it's maybe more reflective, maybe more expansive as the nightly news shows go. I mean, how does that reflect, or how does that influence the work that you do on the sports side? What is a Channel 4 News sports story?
Well, so the brief unofficially for me is sports news. So I call myself the sports news correspondent, mm-hmm. as opposed to my colleagues and friends who are sports news sports correspondents, because my remit, my brief is to be across stories where sports bleeds into news, right? Yeah. So my most regular example is we are less likely, in fact, we're not likely, in fact, we won't do a story on Raheem Sterling won't play this weekend against Burnley because he's got a hamstring strain. But we will do, Raheem Sterling is launching a academy in Brent, West London, where he's from and grew up, to help more kids from Brent get into football and education.
Sure.
That's kind of where my lens is. It's where when sport really becomes the news. So it's normally for often unfortunate stories. So it can be when racism is in the news. It can be when sexism. It can be when homophobia. It can be when corruption. It could be when there's a health issue. These are the things that tend to be what I am more across and what my audience and what my bosses are interested in.
Yeah.
I always have the lens when people ask me, you know, what's your process in terms of pitching a story? Well, it's, I have to think, there's a lady called Margaret who's 64 years old in a town 15 minutes outside of Norwich, who knows nothing about sports, but has a very, very glancing, casual interest in what's happening in sport.
Mm-hmm.
How do I make her care about this story?
Sure.
That's my challenge. How do I make Margaret, who's not a big sports fan, but doesn't mind a little bit of sports news, how do I make her stay watching my piece rather than done the politics, done the international affairs, done the health bit, done the economy bit, sports bit? Nah, make a cuppa. I'll be back for that. And finally, do you know what I mean? That's my job. My mission is, how do I make that particular viewer interested in my sport? So it's, I have to, there's no point in me kind of doing it. You know the phrase inside baseball?
Yeah.
There's no point in me kind of getting into the weeds of this football story, this boxing story, because Margaret doesn't care about what weight said fighter is fighting at. She doesn't care about he's had 12 knockouts and 2 defeats. She doesn't care.
Yeah.
What she cares about is, oh, this guy was on the front line for Ukraine, fighting for Ukraine 2 months ago before he had his own heavyweight fight. Oh, okay, now I'm interested. Do you know what I mean? That's how I have to get that particular viewer engaged in my story.
Yeah.
And that's a challenge that is equally frustrating as it is exciting. It's frustrating on one side, because for years I've always kind of bleated on about, I would just love to do a sports story for sports story's sake. And to be fair, we are doing a little bit more of that. So why has it always got to be a news angle? Why can't it just be, there's a great thing happening this weekend, let's cover it, rather than, well, what's the political angle and what's the economy angle and what's the health angle? No, let's just cover it. Versus the challenge of, which is what I think separates me from a lot of my colleagues, the challenge of, this won't get commissioned if it's just so-and-so is racing so-and-so.
Yeah.
So for racing fans, this is the biggest thing of the week. But for everybody else, eh.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But if the story is these two guys are racing, but they're twins, ooh. Or these two guys are racing, but one guy was done for doping, ooh, now I'm interested.
Yeah.
These two guys are racing, but one is 16 years old and one is Usain Bolt, ooh. Do you know what I mean? So I have to mix that. I'd like to just do sports for sports' sake, because I'm a sports fan, but also remember my audience, my Channel 4 News audience. They're not hardcore sports heads like Sky Sports News, like BBC Sport. Do you know what I mean? So I have to constantly find that angle.
Yeah. How have you developed that muscle, that discipline to switch off the sports fan in your head who's saying, this is a big deal, I'm telling you it's a big deal, I think it's a big deal, to, as you say, relate to Margaret just outside Norwich and what she might think of as relatable or important?
Well, after the 59th pitch that gets rejected because it's not newsy enough, you soon start realizing, I need to finesse these pitches a little bit more differently and tailor it more to our audience. You know what? I joke partially, but I very quickly realized that just being an out and out sports fan and pitching this idea to my editor that this game on the weekend between Arsenal, Manchester United is worthy of more than just a wrap of the goals and the highlights. That, sorry, Jordan, that's not, That's not our audience. They wrap the story for sure. Do a highlights minute of the story for news. Cool. But beyond that, it's not worthy of going anything beyond it and putting resources into it. So I learned very quickly that I just have to find a different angle. I have to put myself in the heads of my viewers and think, what's interesting about this to them? And often it isn't. Sometimes you have to just concede, this is just a boxing story for boxing heads. Mm. This is just a football story. This is not, there's nothing really extra here for casual fans to really be engaged in.
Yeah.
And you have to let it go. But that muscle is developed, but just by having to understand my audience. I do a lot of, I'm a lecturer now at Brighton Uni. I do a lot of talks in schools and colleges and unis. One of my biggest messages, to the students and young people that I speak to is, whether you're a writer or a broadcaster, you have to understand your audience. Mm. You have to. You have to understand that what, so an example of this is when I rock up to a football press conference ahead of the weekend games, I know that the press officer of the Chelsea manager or the Arsenal boss or the Tottenham, wherever it is I may be sent to, they get a bit nervous because unlike all the other guys in the room and girls in the room, I'm not there every single week because I'm not there to talk about the game this weekend. I'm there to talk about, you know, the incident of racism with your fans. I'm there to talk about the fact that there's allegations of sexual abuse with your assistant manager. I'm there to report a story that says this club has embezzled £10 billion. Do you know what I mean? That's why I'm there. Whereas everyone else is asking, so, Jose Mourinho, apparently Ricky Carvalho has got a thigh strain. What's the update on that? Next guy. So, Mourinho, you've lost your last three games. Is the pressure on? Because this game against Arsenal the weekend is really, really big. And then it comes to me. So, Jose, what's your particular stance on the fact that Chelsea supporters were in Paris racially abusing XX such and such? Do you know what I mean? And I was like, ooh,
yeah,
that was a gear change. And it makes people uncomfortable and a bit awkward because my question isn't a football question. My question is a news question. But that's my job. Mm. And I understand that I might get some funny looks. I might get some, oh, here we go, the Channel 4 news guy on one again. But I don't care because I can't afford to care. I'm there to do my job, just like the guy from The Mirror, the guy from Talksport, the guy from The Sun, The Times, everyone else there to serve their audience. I'm no different. I'm there to serve my audience. And my audience wants to know about the 115 charges that your club are being faced with and what's going to... Do you know what I mean? So
yeah.
I learned very quickly that it's all about the audience. I'm doing a job for my audience. And as long as I'm serving them, everything else becomes secondary.
TV news is, you know, it's funny because it's a format that's so familiar to most of us, certainly over a certain age, mm-hmm. right? Not everybody under the age of kind of 25 has grown up watching TV news, but it's so different. I mean, even in the way that you talk about, you know, having to think about a specific audience and maybe an audience that there are so many people working in media now who are creating stuff for an audience that isn't active and what's the word I'm looking for? Motivated audience. They want to find out more about this particular topic that's very important to them. Internet's full of that kind of stuff, obviously. But in TV news, it's like you have 2.5 minutes, maybe max, to tell this story to a general interest audience. I mean, what makes for a really great TV news package? And you know, what are some of the limitations, but also the assets that you're working with in telling that story in that context?
So what makes for an interesting news story is the information and the voices that you can get that possibly other people can't get. So if there's a big story happening, say chances are definitely me, my counterparts at ITV News, Sky Sports and Sky News, BBC News, CNN News, we'll all be covering the same story, right? It's a big story. We're all covering it because it's a story. What makes one person's story stand out, in my opinion, from everybody else's is, oh, they got him. They got him to comment on that. I couldn't quite get to him or her because we're all going to have pretty much the same voices in our packages. But I might have a contact over here that all those guys don't have. So I can get this person to speak about this story as well. Or the Sky guy or the BBC guy might have their contacts that, you know, only speak to them. So I think the first thing is what makes it a good news story is the access to the people that you can get hold of. And the second thing is information. So can I get some off the record stats, quotes, figures, information that nobody else can get? Those are all, that's all ammunition for my report in a way that my counterparts may not get, and vice versa. Do you know what I mean? So my thing is, how do we tell this story that is factual and engaging? Those are the two most important things for me, for a news story: factual and engaging. And engaging is about the pictures that you use. It's the writing that you demonstrate, how you intro your piece, what's your kind of slight take on it. Channel 4 News likes to think, we like to hope and think that we are a bit different in our takes. Mm-hmm. Some people might think that's a little bit arrogant and a little bit up ourselves. Maybe it is. Maybe it is. But we like to try and think a little bit out of the box. But I think fundamentally, a good news story is one that relies on good voices and good information. And if you can get more information than everybody else, if you can get better voices and better interviewees than everybody else, that's only going to add to what is already a very big and good story. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And then just in terms of those other stories that you're pitching yourself, that maybe you're pursuing over a period of weeks, and what are some of the things thematically that interest you in sports since you've moved into this sports news kind of overlap?
Well, I like telling the stories that, well, I try to tell the stories that nobody else is telling. It's not always possible, but I like to think of myself in a position whereby I grew up watching news and watching TV, which was commissioned through a very particular lens. And it wasn't a lens that was particularly inclusive. And it was a very stale lens. I think in some senses, TV is still very stale and repetitive and inside the box thinking, which is a big part of why I think digital has and will obliterate linear television. But that's another discussion for another day. But I'd like
to... Not till the end of your contract, anyway.
Well, yeah. Don't fire me just yet. But I'd like to think that when I was watching television, it was very, very... one, two-dimensional on a particular story or a bit of programming. Whereas I, when I came into this, like to think that I'm constantly thinking, how can I tell the stories that nobody else is telling or hearing? And that could be regarding race, that can be regarding culture, that can be regarding gender, that can be regarding being disabled, that can be regarding class, anything. It's okay, what's the angle of the story that's not being told? How do I make this sound a bit fresh, a bit new? What's the access that I have with the communities that I'm in that can give this story, you know, more legs, more interest, and talk to a wider audience? And I think TV is doing that better now. I think it's too late, but I think it is doing it now. So I think that is, for me, my take on how I try and deliver a story. I'm constantly thinking, who's not being spoken about? What in sport is not being told? What's the story that I think is interesting that's not being told? And it's hard. It takes a lot of time, a lot of work, a lot of research, a lot of phone calls, a lot of trust building. That's key. You've got to build up a lot of trust with a lot of people that want to tell you these stories. I get stuff every single week almost. From people that are saying, this is happening over here, are you interested? We're doing this thing over here, are you interested? And sometimes the brutal answer is no, not really. Or it's, yeah, I'm interested, I'm just not sure we can work it up. Maybe there's not enough parts to really make a story. Also, sometimes some stories are just better at print. Some stories are fantastic stories, but they're just not very picture heavy. They're news articles. So my constant thinking is, how do I tell this story in a different way and ensure that I'm speaking for particular groups that are not being spoken about traditionally?
Yeah. I mean, it takes us into an interesting area. I mean, the track record of UK news media is not great on representation. The track record of UK sports media is not great on representation either. And I think people talk a lot about visibility and opportunity, and I think rightly so. But there's a piece there as well, isn't there, that the stories that you're choosing to tell are also a function of this. Like the stories that are going to be important to certain communities that don't get told because, as you say, of that slightly narrower lens or that that idea of what is a nationally relevant story, you know, is that also something you feel should be challenged or needs to be challenged?
I do, because what or who defines what's a nationally relevant story? Is there a number? Is it, oh, this is only relevant to the new, to the national, to the nation, sorry, if it affects a million people or 20,000 people? What's the number of, who defines what's nationally relevant? My pitch for a story might only be interesting to a community of 5,000 people in the country. That's a minuscule amount of the, what is it, 60 million people in this country? 64 million people, I think it is. But to those people, it's a big story. It's a big story to those people. So we have to kind of have an idea of who are we talking to, who are we talking on behalf of, and ask that question, well, what is nationally relevant? And bearing in mind that we are a national program, we can't, one of the things that I had to learn when I was first in Channel 4 News was a lot of the stuff that I was pitching was regional. It's like, yeah, that's a really interesting story in that part of South London. But if you're in Newcastle, Northumberland, if you're in Norwich, if you're in Cardiff, if you're in Scotland, do you care about this thing happening in some part of South London? Maybe you do, but maybe you don't. So mm-hmm. I think it's that balance of ensuring that what we deliver the news that affects the whole country, but not be blinded or even snobby to things that maybe are only affecting or interesting to a particular part of the country. That doesn't mean it's any less interesting. That story you're telling me about that's happening in that part of the Midlands doesn't affect me, doesn't interest me, but that doesn't mean it's not worthy of a new segment. Do you know what I mean? So
yeah.
I think it's a constant battle of who decides and determines what is of national interest. And you've only got a finite minutes of telly to fill, right? And one of the big things that I often think about with our program and all news programs is the amount of coverage we give to Donald Trump. I think we give Donald Trump an inordinate amount of coverage. Now, I understand that Donald Trump is the leader of one of the biggest nations and one of the most significant nations on the planet. Cool. I understand that Donald Trump is running his country and to a degree large parts of the world in a way that impacts the world, including the UK. I get that. But we have to also be honest and say that because Donald Trump is Donald Trump, he drives numbers, he drives ratings. So even if the story isn't huge, you know when you put Donald Trump on a story or in a thumbnail or in your headline bits at the top of your program, you know that's gonna create ratings. Cool. Mm-hmm. But is every Donald Trump story warranting of 3.5 minutes and a discussion at the back? Is every Donald Trump story relevant to people in this country? Some are. Maybe most are all. I'm not sure all. So I think that there's a discussion there in terms of who determines what goes on your program.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that, you know, you talked about the capacity for digital media to open up different avenues for storytellers. And the other thing that you've done is created your own production company, Blackademic. What can you tell us about that and what the aims were for setting that up?
Yeah, sure. So I was in TV for quite a few years. I'm working at Channel 4 News for a few years. And I realized, so, okay, we go back. This is at a time when the zeitgeist was, there was an epidemic of knife crime across London. And it's all these black boys without black fathers in the home. This is why we have this epidemic knife crime. I was like, hang on a minute. It's coming from people like Piers Morgan and Nigel Farage and Nick Ferrari and Lawrence Fox. All these guys that just didn't know what they were talking about. And it was very detrimental and dangerous to my community, to my people. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, I want to change the narrative around what mainstream media is saying about my particular community. I don't like that. So I started a show on YouTube called It's All Blackademic. And it was a debate show that I hosted. And we would talk about issues pertaining to black culture and black people. And we would discuss. And it wasn't all a kumbaya in agreement. We'd have people that were on one side of an argument, others on the other side. But it was a discussion that we had as a community. If we decide and we think that the problem with knife crime is our kids' problem and it's because we don't have dads in our homes, then we'll have that chat. It wasn't. It was nonsense. But even if it was, You don't have, who the hell are you to be telling us, no, we'll have that chat internally and we'll address it as a community. And so we did like, bloody hell, 10 seasons of that for about 3 years. And after filming that show for quite a while, I realized that I was using the same crew. Mm-hmm. And I also realized that while I was doing other work on TV for Channel 4 or other people, everyone behind the camera was a white boy called Mark. It's like, how many Marks do we need on set? It's like 7 Marks. You know, the camera guy's Mark, the director's called Mark, the editor's called Mark, the sound was like, all these white boys, they're 27 years old, called Mark. And I was like, what's going on? So I was like, hang on a minute, where are the women? Where are the black people? Where are the disabled people? I know lots of people that are camera operators, sound techs, editors, producers, etc. So that was kind of my thinking behind setting up this All Black Academic. And then we morphed into a production company where we're doing content now still, but we did less content, but we're now like a gun for hire.
Yeah.
But I think the USP of my company is that because we have a diverse team, we have women, disabled people, gay people, older people, younger people, people that are not from this country. When we deliver a project or a job for a particular client, that diversity of pot that goes in the pot of our group, I think brings out a better product, because you're getting a team of people that aren't all 27, aren't all white, aren't all male, and aren't all called Mark. Do you know what I mean? You're getting different people that have different lenses on things, where I think if you have a soup and you have different ingredients you put in, it makes for a better soup. Now, you don't want to put in too many different ingredients, otherwise you'll spoil it. But equally, a soup with no salt, with no pepper, with no sauce, that's not a nice soup. Nobody wants that soup. Do you know what I mean? So I saw Black Academic as an antidote, one, to change the narrative around mainstream media, of which it had on my community. But second of all, as a production company, because I just wasn't seeing all the people that I knew were talented and hardworking have opportunities to work behind the camera. So I just thought, I'll do it myself.
Yeah.
And I've got an amazing team now of people that are all talented and are all amazing. We do some great work.
Yeah. Poor Mark, though.
I know.
Really,
I know.
Attacked.
But people that work on TV and production will kind of know what the point I'm making. It's just like, there was a very, it's different to a degree now, but there was a very same type of white boy that I was just seeing behind the camera. It was like, I thought you were, didn't you just drop me up? Hang on a minute. Oh, there's more than one of you. You did that. It's crazy.
I mean, again, it comes down to that thing. You know, we talked a little bit about stories and story choice being a big thing. And I guess expanding people's skill sets, but also giving them the sense that you can belong here. This isn't, you know, there's not a barrier to entry here beyond anything other than your capacity to do the work, which I think in lots of kind of soft skill industries or should we say non-linear industries like media and television, you know, that can be, that there can be a kind of received attitude that certain people feel comfortable there and certain people don't.
Totally. But with my company, with my business, as long as you're prepared to work hard, I don't even really care how good you are, because we have people on set that shadow and work with us, younger people and older people that are young in terms of their career in production. They'll just watch and work with my crew and learn. Everybody has to learn somewhere. Everyone's got to make mistakes somewhere. Everyone's got to have a mentor or someone they can look at and be like, oh, okay, this is why you frame your shot this way. Mm-hmm. This is why the lighting is really important. This is why the audio, you have to do this. This is why when you're editing, we've all got to learn somewhere. Do you know what I mean? So I don't have all I care about is, are you prepared to work? And are you serious about this? And also ideas. Ideas are a massive currency in this industry. If you've got ideas, not every idea is going to be good. Not every idea is going to be commissioned. But if you're someone that's got ideas and, I didn't think of that. Why don't we shoot it like this? And why don't we storyboard it like this? If you've got all that, you can work with me. I'll bring you on board. It's not a problem for me.
Yeah. And what do you see as the kind of pathway there? Is it a talent pathway that you see that as providing, or do you see it as being a production company can scale up to work on bigger projects over time?
Both. And we're doing both. Both. I think one, we've got people that are worked with us as juniors and are now fully part of my crew now. but we've also got ourselves to a point where we've got that balance right of never forgetting that we're here to try and help people into the industry, but balance that with, but equally, we want to be working with some big clients that expect a good product and high, at a high quality. So if we don't produce what the brief from a Netflix or a LinkedIn or an Adidas or a FIFA or any other brands that we work with, if Arsenal, if we don't produce our product to a certain standard, they just won't come back. So I have to get that balance right of, you know, there's a standard here. There's a standard here that we have to meet. We're a business. We're here to make money and we're here to do good work. But that doesn't have to be independent of also helping people at the same time.
Yeah.
And trying to bring through young people. Some people come and they work with us for a while, then they leave and they leave the industry for whatever reason. That's fine. That can happen. But we're here to kind of offer that chance to people that want to just shadow us, want to work with us, and do good stuff.
Yeah.
And it's that balance of, making sure that we do remember people that want to come in, but also remember we have a job to do. We have a standard to maintain.
Yeah. Okay. The big part of your backstory, you were a wheelchair athlete.
Yes,
I was. You were a Paralympics presenter. Or do you need to get that?
That's the Amazon guy. Can I come back in literally? Don't cut this out. I'll be 30 seconds. Hang on. One sec. Right. See? That was in some ways perfect timing. Because this is the life. For those, the audio can't see this, but this is video as well, isn't it?
It is video, but okay. I was going to cut this bit out, but you can.
No, because this is real. So this is actually, I won't give my address there. Sorry. But this is part of my life now as well. This is a hard drive. So getting hard drives, backing up footage, sending it. I've got to send this to one of my editors after this call. That's a big part of my, as a production founder, that's a big part of my job now. There you go.
Absolutely. Storage is a weekly crisis when you're bootstrapping a podcast, I'll tell you that.
I'm drowning in hard drives, you know what I mean? But it's fine.
Yeah, big basketball. Part of your backstory. Yeah, wheelchair basketball and also you were a presenter on the Paralympics for Channel 4 as well, 2012, 2016?
Have I got that right? I've done the last four. I did 2012, 2016, 2021. It was late because of COVID. And yep. I did 2024 last year, yeah.
I mean, how, you know, the Paralympics has been a huge thing for visibility for people with disabilities. But what do you think, what's your assessment of how sports media does at talking about those experiences a bit more in the round? It's kind of got very comfortable with that Paralympic story of, you know, excellence and overcoming hardship and everything else. But could it get better at the broader story for people with disabilities?
It can get better. It has to get better. And it will get better. I think there's two things with this. The first thing I think is for a long time, I think Channel 4 and TV is still grappling with the issue of how to platform disability sports in between cycles. So I think Channel 4 does an amazing job of broadcasting, platforming, displaying Paralympic excellence the weeks leading up to the Paralympic Games and during the Games. But then, and I can't quite work out, well, I've got a theory on this, but I won't reveal that, but a struggle to really nail down why it doesn't do that during the cycles, right? So it's like, right, Paralympics over, we'll see you in 4 years' time. And whilst Paralympic sport is still a minority sport, it's a minority competition. It's huge in that it's a massive global competition.
Yeah.
But it's not football. It's not tennis. So we have to understand that. But it's still a global competition, you know. And within that, you've got, 15, 20, 25 sports within it. So it's huge. But I think we have to try and answer that question of how do we get Paralympic sports or disability sports on our screens throughout the Paralympic cycles? I think the other thing as well is I still think to this day, the marketing and advertising campaign that Channel 4 displayed leading up to the London 2012 Paralympics was still to this day the best marketing sports event campaign I've ever seen in my life. the Superhumans campaign was the best, and I think for this country for sure, but maybe globally, the most important marketing campaign I've ever seen in sports. I don't know if you remember it, the whole, you know, Superhumans campaign. There was these billboards that went up. I remember when I saw the first one around the corner from where I live, just after, because there's a gap between the Olympics and the Paralympics of like, I think it's like a week or 10 days.
Yeah.
There was a billboard that went up the day after the final day of the Olympics. And it was just a black billboard. And it simply said, "Thank you for the warm-up, Channel 4. I just thought it was genius. I just thought it was just genius. And they really made the Paralympics feel, the Paralympians feel like we are worthy of being seen on the global stage and by being respected for the athletes that we are and the great things that we do in a way that prior to 2012 had never happened before. However, what I didn't realize until a couple of years later was that whilst I think the Paralympians and people into sport were blown away, impressed, and some, it's a word that I use very, very infrequently, I think it's one of the most overused words in the English language, inspired. I remember doing reports on disabled stories, some sports related, some not sports related. And I heard from people that were saying, "Jordan, the London 2012 Games, Channel 4, smashed it. Absolutely phenomenal. We felt seen. We were visible. We were being shown as the world-class athletes that we are." But for me, Jordan, I felt like shit. We felt like rubbish, right? I was like, "What do you mean?" He's like, "Well, think about it. How many people are Paralympians in this country?" I was like, "Oh." And then I got it.
Yeah.
I got it. 1%, if that, of disabled people in the UK are Paralympians. So the message that it, whilst the message of aspiration, inspiration, respect, I think was all felt by the campaign and what Channel 4 did, for people that were disabled who weren't into sport or weren't athletes, it made them feel like, well, look, so if I'm not playing table tennis with no arms, I'm not amazing. If I'm not swimming with one leg and one arm, I'm not amazing. If I'm not playing wheelchair basketball and scoring a three-pointer whilst falling out of my chair, I'm not amazing.
Mm.
What about me, Jordan? And I was like, oh, I get it.
Yeah.
And it was a real light bulb moment for me whereby I think what we did was correct, but we didn't think about the majority of people, the 99% of people who are disabled in the UK who are not Paralympians and never going to be Paralympians.
Yeah.
Now, how you get around that, I don't quite know. And Channel 4, I think, have done better in fusing the excellence of Paralympians with the everyday disabled person that doesn't care about sport. But I don't think we've quite cracked it yet.
Yeah.
So I forgot what your question was, but I think we've done some really important work, but I think there's some more work to be done for TV to ensure that the athletes, Paralympians, disabled athletes, get the platform and the showcase that they deserve that they're not getting.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing, you know, I remember this from conversations with people at the IPC as well, and they had their We the 15 campaign, I think, around Tokyo. Which again was kind of was targeted at a similar issue, which is okay, you're watching these guys, but actually we're talking about an enormous number of people around the world who are living
most
with disabilities.
Yeah,
and the other issue when the Paralympics becomes such a singular focus for that story is that you're waiting like 2 to 4 years almost for people to be ready to have that conversation again. You know what I mean? It's like people kind of earmark it, like particularly in a very calendar focused industry like sport and like media can be. Well, we'll have that conversation then. When the Paralympics come round, that'll be the time to talk about representation of people with disabilities and the way that we tell those stories.
And we don't, because the sport is so enthralling and we're so focused on the actual sport of 10 days of Paralympic sport, we tend to not do it. So yeah. You're right, they say they're going to do it, but then it's like, oh, we'll do it when the Paralympics comes round. But then when it comes around, oh, now's not the right time. Now we're just focused on the sport.
Yeah.
So you end up not speaking about it at all. So, yeah, sorry to interrupt you there. But
yeah, and I mean, you know, I you know, I've been an editor and I include myself in that kind of that search for a hook for these kind of thematic discussions. But the something you've done is you've inevitably, because it's 2025, you've started another podcast.
Yeah. Because that's what the world needs, another podcast. Yeah.
I mean, what's your mission with that? It's called the World's Coolest Disabled.
Yeah. I've been planning it for about a year before we launched, because I wanted to do another podcast, but I didn't want to just do another podcast that just another football podcast, yay, or you know, another podcast about race. Yeah, there's plenty of great football podcasts and podcasts about culture and race that are out there. I can't improve on that, right? So the world doesn't need another Arsenal podcast. So I thought, okay, so what is it that I? This is the question that I asked myself. What is the value that I can offer the world that isn't currently being served? Like, okay. Disability. I was like, there's lots of podcasts on race, plenty of podcasts on gender, plenty of podcasts on for the gay community, plenty of podcasts on sport, beauty, tech, whatever, films, music. There's no content for disabled people. If you're disabled, where do you go for content? Apart from the Paralympics, which is very, very sports focused every 4 years, where do you go to hear stories from those people? So I just thought, okay, we've seen a gap of content. I have experience in doing podcasts. I interview people for a living. It's my job. I've got a production company and I have access to really interesting people and voices. Duh. Well, there you go. There's your podcast, Jordan. And I just thought being disabled as well, I could bring a level of value and lived experience, this phrase, that other people couldn't. But I thought, okay, now, right, rather than just having a podcast where you just sit down and interview disabled people about being disabled, yeah, that'll probably like peak after episode 6 and then it'll just tail off, right? It's like, what is it that you can do that gives people a reason to keep coming back to the podcast? So the full name of the podcast, which I noticed you didn't give it, by the way, which was Jordan Jarrett Bryan's The World's Coolest Disabled, enabled me to have a little bit of fun with the podcast and have other people challenge me and say, well, actually, no, Jordan, you're not. Okay, cool. Well, let's see how cool you are. That was a lighthearted part of it. But the serious part was, I think that disabled people, not all, but many that I come across and work with, seriously lack confidence. I think they lack confidence because they've been told, or there's a perception at least, that if you're in a wheelchair, if you have multiple sclerosis, cerebral palsy, blind, one leg, whatever it may be, you're not cool. You're not cool. You're all right, but you're not really cool. And I'm like, F that, you're doing something really interesting and cool. Let's shout about it. If you won't, I will. You're doing something really interesting and cool. Let's shout about it. So the fun element is, who's the coolest person in the world? It's obviously me, but we have fun people challenging me on that. But the more important and serious part of the podcast is people that are doing really interesting and cool things that you would never know about because they're not shouting about it and nobody else is. These are the same people that will only, and I'm guilty of this as well, and our newsroom. These are people that will only be called on TV to talk about things that are specifically around their disability, which I get the logic behind it. If there's a government policy that's going to cut PIP, you want to hear from disabled people. Right, cool. But I just don't think we're not defined by our gender, our race, our disability, or anything like that. These are all things that make up who we are. Your disability is one part of who you are. So I just thought, okay, let's have a little bit of fun with it, but let's really talk about the ups and downs. And the ups are important as well, because another thing I want to say is that we don't often hear about the lives of people who have great lives, who are disabled. Again, it's a narrative that every disabled person is angry about being disabled or resentful or really just struggling with their disability. Some people are. Some people are having very difficult lives because of their disability. That is facts. But some people aren't. Some people are living their best lives and they're like, I'm blind. I get on with it. You know, I have no legs. I crack on. And that's easier for some people than others. I accept it. But I wanted to do a podcast that was honest and real and spoke to the realities of being disabled, but also was uplifting and joyous and was like, you know, let's chat about what you do. The final element to the podcast was conversations. So rather than just be a, you know, I lost my leg because of blah, blah, blah. Because the fact is, the reality is, most people do not have an interesting story about how they became disabled. It was either they were born that way or something happened and some tissue failure happened and they had to lose a part of their body. It's not that interesting. My story is not... Very few people have a... I'm watching this program on ITVX, actually. My friend's in it, Adia Deputan. It's 10 celebrities swimming with sharks. And, you know, there's one of the hosts of the show. He lost his arm and leg to a shark attack, right? Most people don't lose their limbs to a shark, right? He is the extreme minority. That is a really cool story to tell people at a party / chat up line. Really good. But most of us have a very boring story about our limb loss, right? So I don't care about how you became disabled because 9 times out of 10, it's not very interesting. What I do care about are things like dating, sex, and relationships. We talk about that a lot. What is it like dating in a chair or with brittle bones or short stature or being blind? Sex. We talk about sex. Everyone else does. Why can't we? We talk about the job market. Getting jobs, losing jobs, confidence in the job market. We talk about families, religions, how do they respond to you being disabled? These are all things we don't hear about that we discuss on my podcast. So it's a multifaceted answer there as to how the podcast came about. But essentially, it was because there was a gap in the market. I feel like someone that has credibility in this space to kind of bring this product to the community and beyond. And thirdly, it's having conversations that we don't often have. And finally on this, I would say, unless you've got more questions, disabled people are the largest minority group on the planet.
Yeah.
Everybody will know somebody who's disabled. You might not be friends with a black person. You might not be comfortable with gay people because you're maybe homophobic. You might not know closely someone who's working class, but everybody knows someone who's disabled. Everyone does. So the podcast isn't just for disabled people. It's for parents. We had a parent on who's got a daughter with a severe disability. I'm interested in that perspective. So it's also for people that aren't disabled because they may learn something about the experience of disability as well.
Yeah. And what are you learning from that you can take forward into other parts of your journalism and your storytelling?
Good question. Well, from a kind of purely professional point of view, it's really pushing me and challenging me on my questions. Mm-hmm. I take a lot of pride in, as a journalist, the questions that I ask. I'm not funny. I'm not that good looking. I'm not overly charismatic. I'm not the most intelligent or informative person. But one thing I do pride myself on is asking the right question. Not all the time. No one's perfect. Mm-hmm. I've asked questions where I'm like, really, Jordan? Or after the thought, man, that was a really dumb question, Jordan. Or the way you worded it was stupid. So we're not infallible. But it's really pushing me in researching what is a thing that I can ask this person that will elicit something different or new or interesting. And this doesn't always happen. I might have an amazing question. Doesn't mean it's going to get an amazing answer. So I can't control what the person on the other side answers, only what I ask them. Empathy and, you know, a level of empathy. The stories I've heard from people, some of them are hilarious and we have a lot of fun on the pod. But some are very, very sad. Some are very, very sad. And it's like, okay, how do you hear this story, Jordan? And how do you treat that story? Yeah. How do you know when to, okay, maybe we leave it there now and move on to a different subject versus let's dig a little bit deeper. Is this person emotionally wanting to give a little bit more? So it's really helping my empathetic skills, my listening skills. It's also helping me understand what I deem interesting and what I deem cool. You know, it's like this thing for most people is quite interesting and cool. Is it interesting and cool to me? Nah, not really. And being able to say, what you're doing is great. It's just not really doing it for me. So these are all things that I think I've learned from the podcast that I can take into my wider form of journalism.
Yeah. You, on that topic, are kind of learning and self-criticism and all that sort of stuff. You mentioned a bit earlier, you've recently become a lecturer to journalism students. I mean, what's your experience been of that? And what are some of the things that you're trying to communicate?
I love it.
Those guys.
I love it. Honestly, I wanted to be a lecturer. I wanted to lecture for a long time. I've done talks in schools and colleges and universities and prisons and youth centres for years. I've done that for a very, very, very long time. I enjoy that. But there's a difference, and this was a challenging thing for me, because it's one thing going into a university or a college for an hour and talking about journalism or entry points to media or being black in media or being disabled in journalism. That's one thing. I can just talk about anecdotes of things that have happened to me and give advice, right? That's cool. Do an hour, give that, and then I can leave. I've got people's future in my hands. I'm responsible in part to how well you do in your degree, which will potentially, probably inform how well you do in your later life beyond university. So I've taken that very, very seriously. This is not just me showing a few videos and telling a few tales about my time in journalism. It's like, no. I need to make sure that come the end of the course, you feel confident enough and informed enough to be able to go into that exam hall or submit your paper and know the answers to the questions and be able to write what it is you need to write. If you come out of that, I can accept if you failed. If you have failed, then I can accept that. It's not great. It's not nice, but I can accept that. What I can't accept is if you say by the end of the course, Jordan, I didn't understand. I didn't understand. That's a failure on my part. I failed. I failed you. My job is to make sure that come the end of the course, you now feel confident that you can go into how you execute it in exam time or submission time. I can't control that. That's up to you. The execution is all on you. But everything before that, I can affect. And I'm supposed to affect. So I take it. I've loved it. And that challenge is something I've really enjoyed. I had it was my first year. I had an amazing class. My group was just, they were so engaged, so wanting to learn, but they were raw.
Yeah.
So I got to kind of shape them and really mold them into these young men and women that could have a chance of working in my industry. And I'm really, really happy for them. I'm really glad. I think they all passed their first year. And they all were really complimentary to me about my style of teaching and what I offered, which made me feel good. Because I'm like, right, okay, I did something good that now year two, I can, with other people, I can do that again, not thinking, that whole year did it wrong. I've got to now reevaluate how I do it again. But I've loved it. I've loved it.
Yeah. And not to get too like Dead Poets Society about it, but what did you learn from them? What, particularly because we talk so much about, you know, I mean, we mentioned it earlier, like the media consumption that you and I had growing up is different from people who are only now coming into their 20s. Like, what did you learn about how they think about storytelling, how they think about media?
It's a good question. What did I learn from them? So I didn't go to university. I didn't do university. I did a year and a half of college. What I learned from them, one of the things I learned from them, was discipline and patience are two key things when you're studying for a degree. One of my course leader, so my boss basically, said to me that he expects of the 42 people that enrolled at the start of the year, he says, don't be disheartened if half of them by the end have dropped out. Six dropped out. So the fact the majority of them stuck with it for the entirety was something that I really respected. You know, they didn't give up. They didn't quit. It was harder for some more than others, but they all finished the year. Now, again, whether they passed or failed, I think a couple did fail their first year for various reasons, but whether they passed or failed, I just respected. And I respected them for the fact that they just were, they were persistent and patient, which sounds like a contradiction, but it's not. And they had the discipline to keep going every week, learning more, reading more, doing what I told them. I could see by the end that they were doing the things that I was telling them to do. And I respected that. It's been very easy for them to have just, this is not for me, and given up. I respected their persistence for sure. And I learned a lot about when you start something, you finish it. For better or for worse, when you start something, you finish it. And all bar one, they all finished it. They all finished it. And that's something that I was very, very, yeah, I was in awe of. Because you don't have to finish it. You could just be like, this is hard. Nah, I'm out of here now. But they all stuck with it, for better or for worse.
Okay.
Also, sorry. One other thing I learned from them, I loved teamwork. I loved how they worked with each other and they bounced off each other. That was really good to see. Some were more advanced than others. Some knew more about sports than others. Some knew more about the media than others. But they all helped each other. And I admired that massively.
Cool. Okay. Sounds like they're on a firm footing there, but I think we'll leave the kind of main part of the conversation on that note. We've got three questions that we ask everybody who comes on the podcast. The first is, do you have an origin story of your own or something that kind of sparked your interest in sport?
Yeah, I was thinking about this. The origins of my interest in sports. So I guess it goes back to when I was about five or so. One of my dad's best friends, and it's the reason why I support Arsenal, was an absolute Arsenal nut. Absolute, he was just crazy. Whenever we'd go into the house, their house, Arsenal were always on the TV. He also loved a lot of other sports as well. Like there was always sport on the TV, but it was normally Arsenal. And his enthusiasm, I was always into kind of sports at a young age and I liked playing. I wasn't very good, but I liked football. But his enthusiasm for football just really rubbed off on me. But it wasn't just that he was enthusiastic about football. He was into the politics of football. He was mm-hmm. into the culture of football. He was into how football made him feel, how it shaped his day, his week. I never quite went that far, but I just loved the effect that a win or a loss or a draw or a goal or a red card or a decision, I loved how that made him feel. The art. He was always banging about the art of football. He loved footballers that were artists. And football's not just a sport. It's an art. Tactics can be artistic. A goal can be artistic. A save can be... So all these elements of the game, he demonstrated times 10. And I think that's when I was like, yeah, I like your sport. Now I love it. I love mm-hmm. it. Because I see it's more than just 22 men kicking a ball around.
Yeah, absolutely.
All women,
absolutely. Mm-hmm. What's your favorite piece of sports storytelling?
So it was one of my colleagues did wrote an article around the time of, so Paul Pogba was at Manchester United, and it was at the height of when he was going for a bit of a difficult time. And there was a narrative around him that I didn't like and many black people mm-hmm. didn't like. Paul Pogba was a very expressive football player. He had really expressive haircuts. He, you know, off the pitch, he wore really flamboyant clothing. He wore an earring, drove certain cars, and he would do dance moves on the pitch when he scored a goal. And it was this narrative that this is the reason why Paul Pogba's struggling. This is the reason why Man United are not doing very, very well. He's got to stop it. Stop all that sort of stuff. And a friend and colleague of mine wrote an amazing article that, and this person, by the way, wasn't even black, which I thought was even more significant, wrote this amazing article about the nuances of culture in football. Mm-hmm. And it was telling the story of how Paul Pogba shows up and carries himself isn't an act. It's not something he turns on at 3 p.m. on a Saturday. It's who he is. And when mm-hmm. you're a black man who's of French African descent, music is a big part of the culture. Fashion is a big part of the culture. Dancing is a big part of the culture. These are all things that are expressive for black people and other people as well, but I'll speak to my community because that's what I know. It's a big part of who we are. So when we score a goal, the little swag, the little bit of that's what we do. And the people were equating that to his level of performance. Now, there were times when Paul Pogba wasn't playing very well, mm-hmm. for sure. I was a critic of his for many games. But the idea that you're linking the two, I just thought really missed who Paul Pogba was and where he'd come from. And I thought that was a really great bit of storytelling to those that were uninformed or just ignorant. It was,
No,
this is who Paul Pogba is. If you knew about Paul Pogba's background and where he comes from, you'd understand that you can't separate Paul Pogba from the dancing or the fashion or the music or all the things that the food, all those things which are, that's him. You take that away, you take something from him. You don't get the same Paul Pogba. So that was definitely an example for me, I thought, of really good storytelling that nailed a narrative that I thought was at times quite sinister, but at best was misinformed and ignorant.
Yeah. Can you remember who wrote that?
I can remember. It was a writer called Miguel Delaney, I believe, who I think he still works for The Independent.
Yeah,
I think it was Independent. I just thought it was well written. He's a brilliant writer, but I just think it nailed something that all Black people knew. We all knew this is what was going on, but for him to have known that and seen that. In the face of people, a lot of middle-aged white men that were just like, why is he dancing? Why is his hair blue? Why is he doing this? Why is he doing music? It's like, this is why, because who he is.
Yeah, I mean, it ties back to some of the things we were talking about earlier as well. I think 100%. It's really interesting example. What is a sports story that you'd like to tell or see someone else tell?
See, this is a tricky one because I can't say it because I'm working on it. I won't tell you the story specifically that I think should be told that's not being told because I want to tell it. But I do think there needs to be more writing, similar to what I've just said about Paul Pogba, more writing that's nuanced about the merger or the crossover between Black culture and sport, football in particular. I think there's so many things that are unknown about why things happen, where politics, culture, and sport mixes. I think we'll get a lot more of that. I think under current governments, under certain administrations and certain governing bodies in sports, I think we're going to have problems. I think the World Cup next year in America is going to be very interesting for cultural and political reasons. But I think there needs to be a lot more scrutiny and a lot more writing done, a lot more work done that underpins or just basically dispels this myth that politics and football shouldn't mix. My head explodes when I hear people say that because I'm like, politics is sport. Sport is politics. That doesn't mean that you can't have sports in a form of sport, but you can't detach it from politics and culture. This is what makes sport sport. I don't see how people see it any other way. So I think I would love to see people do a little bit more work on that kind of triangle of sports, politics and culture.
Okay. Well, you've got an opportunity to do that yourself as well,
Jordan. I will.
Channel 4 News. But I think we're going to have to leave it there. But it's been a blast. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me, man. Enjoyed it.
Outlines is an original production from 2640.